mysterious symbols of our lives as vulnerable, loving, doubting, desiring beings on this earth. My walk this evening circles around that contradiction. What would Charlotte Bronte have made of this sacred place, with its icons and gold mosaics, its candles and lace veils and Virgin Mothers of God? Her fierce Protestant soul would have scorned it as idolatry, I expect. How odd that she has turned up as my companion on this walk, that her spirit, out of those of all the dead writers I love so much, should have risen up at magical dusk and come to stroll alongside me. What would Charlotte have made of this precipitous funicular trip down the hillside towards the prospect of dinner? She's clutching her hat with one hand, her ballooning crinoline with the other, and smiling. She's coming with me to a yurt-shaped cafe to sample Uzbek food. A mutton pilaf with pine nuts and raisins. A salad of white radish, beef strips and peas, washed down with tall glasses of good local beer. Blue darkness surrounds us, full of possibility. We savour it together. The next city walk. The next unexpected encounter.
Dusk Walk was presented by Michelle Roberts. The producer was Duncan Minshall. Well, welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall with me, Penny Gore, live on BBC Radio 3. The BBC Symphony Orchestra are back at the Proms tonight for their penultimate appearance this season. They've just returned from the Edinburgh International Festival, where they were in the orchestra pit with Opera Australia for the UK premiere of the Australian composer Brett Dean's first opera. It's called Bliss, based on the book by Peter Carey and with a libretto by Amanda Holden. They gave two performances at the Edinburgh Festival Theatre, which were recorded for broadcast on BBC Radio 3 early next year, and won rave reviews for what was evidently a very impressive operatic debut. Well, tonight there's a new way to hear this prom online. For the rest of the season, we're offering an extra high-quality audio stream that can be connected to your hi-fi, or if you prefer, you can listen through headphones. To access it, just go to the Proms website, bbc.co.uk/proms, and click on the High Quality Listening tab on the homepage. And please do let us know what you think. Well, for the rest of tonight's BBC Symphony Orchestra prom, we're returning, in part at least, to the spirit of Wagner, with a symphony by one of his most devoted admirers in the 19th century, Anton Bruckner. His Seventh Symphony was written as Wagner's life was drawing to a close, and one of its movements stands as a memorial, composed when Bruckner heard of his hero's death. When he began his first sketches for the symphony, though, in the late summer of 1881, Bruckner had no special plan in mind, except for a determination to keep on going in the face of wearying criticism. None of his previous six symphonies had attracted major acclaim. It's true that there have been some successful performances, especially of the fourth, and a few loyal supporters had championed his music, but he'd never quite managed the vital breakthrough to wider fame. And part of the reason for the hostility against him, in some quarters, was his innocent hero worship of Wagner. That put him firmly into the enemy camp in the view of the critic Eduard Hanslick, one of the most influential figures on the Viennese music scene, and definitely not a man to cross. But Bruckner's dogged faith in his own abilities had kept him slogging ever onwards. And in the summer of 1882, he had a boost to the spirits when he heard Wagner's Parsifal for the first time on a trip to Bayreuth. He finished the symphony's scherzo and first movement a couple of months after that, but he was devastated when news arrived the following spring that Wagner had died in Venice. He'd already sketched out the symphony's adagio, and now he went back to the score and added tenor and bass tubas, as heard in The Ring, and wrote a new sombre coda as a funeral ode for Wagner. The last movement to be finished was the finale, and Bruckner's symphony finally had its premiere in December 1884. That was in Leipzig rather than in Vienna, with another performance in Munich in the spring of the following year. The completed work was dedicated to King Ludwig of Bavaria. Bruckner had to ask for special permission to do so. And there's a strong Wagner link there too. The king had been one of Wagner's great patrons and, as it happens, a particular admirer of Lohengrin. Well, the decision to hold the first performance of the symphony outside of Vienna paid off. At last, Bruckner got the chance to enjoy real acclaim. There was a 15-minute ovation at the end of the performance, and critics praising him for genius approaching that of Beethoven, and indeed in certain properties worthy of comparison with Beethoven. And another added that the work calls for the highest admiration. Well, we're about to hear that work, Bruckner's Symphony No. 7, coming on stage to conduct the BBC Symphony Orchestra is Jiří Bělohlávek. Bruckner's majestic Seventh Symphony, the last of three symphonies by the composer to be performed at the BBC Proms this season. Played tonight by the BBC Symphony Orchestra under its chief conductor, Jerzy Bielaklawek. And what a relief it must have been to Bruckner to have praise showered on him after the premiere of that piece, after so many years in the wilderness. Mind you, he wasn't praised by everybody. His nemesis, Eduard Hanslick, still couldn't bring himself to be gracious and rudely call the symphony bumptious, morbid and debased. But obviously nothing was ever going to turn him into a fan. Plenty of fans here at the Royal Albert Hall tonight, though. You can hear those cheers for Jerzy Bielaklawek and the BBC Symphony Orchestra. A solo bow for Daniel Palethorpe. The principal flute. Richard Simpson, the principal oboe. The clarinetist, those Wagner tubas, led by Nicholas Korth. And the principal horn now, Martin Owen. And the trumpets getting their solo applause. The trombones, marvellous contribution the brass make to this symphony. John Chimes, the timpanist, doing sterling work throughout that piece, and the whole orchestra now rising. Well, the BBC Symphony Orchestra is gearing up for its autumn season of concerts, not that far away, and that'll include their 80th birthday celebration on the 22nd of October. But they have one more appointment at the BBC Proms this year, and that is on Saturday, the last night, of course. Well, tomorrow at 7:30, the BBC Philharmonic will be here with Gianandrea Noseda, conducting them in Schubert, Schumann, Mozart, and another BBC commission by Robin Holloway. But there is still another prom to come this evening, and John Shea can tell you all about that. So I'll say good night and hand you back to him in Broadcasting House.
Thank you to Penny Gore at the Royal Albert Hall. Well, there is indeed another prom to come tonight, but you don't have to take my word for it. Here's Catherine Bott.
Tonight, the BBC Proms celebrates a band of musicians whose fans span the generations and whose work is in a class of its own, Penguin Cafe. It's a latter-day reincarnation of the Penguin Cafe Orchestra, founded in 1972 by Simon Jeffs. Simon's son Arthur, who now leads the band, says of its music, "One description I like at the moment is that it's a kind of modern chamber folk." Join me, Catherine Bott, to hear the music for yourself as Penguin Cafe perform live in a late-night prom tonight at 10:15 here on BBC Radio 3.
Well, before that, you can hear a prom's composer portrait of Tansy Davis, whose new work was played in the first half of tonight's BBC Symphony Orchestra prom. Tom Service will be presenting that, and that's in a little over 10 minutes at 9:15. So in the meantime, let's hear the sound of the Royal Albert Hall organ. One of the first people to make a recording there after the instrument's restoration a few years ago was Simon Preston, and here he is with two of the six fugues on the name Bach, which Schumann completed in 1845.
Thank you.
the work which I believe will longest outlive my others, so said Robert Schumann when he completed his 6 fugues based on the name Bach. That's the notes that are named B-A-C-H in German. He'd worked on the pieces for almost a year, trying, as he put it, to make them worthy of the name they bore. Well, those were the first 2 of the fugues. Simon Preston played them on the Royal Albert Hall organ, and he made that recording in 2006. This is BBC Radio 3, and tonight's Proms Composer Portrait follows this.
Tormented genius or malicious drunk?
Am I endowed with a unique and awesome gift? My God, yes, I'm afraid so.
Never anything more than a mediocre artist. At best, believe me, I should know, shouldn't I?
He was a convoluted man.
Miracle worker or charlatan?
Am I a con man? Which, of course, was nonsense. I think...
3 characters in 4 monologues of shifting memories.
The fantastic...
Francis Hardy.
Faith Healer.
Drama on 3 presents Brian Friel's mesmerising play about faith, art and love. Performed by Owen Rowe, Leah Williams and Phil Daniels.
Let's just say I did it because I could do it.
Such a twisted man.
Just a little bit thoughtless.
Faith Healer. This Sunday night at 8 o'clock here on BBC Radio 3.
Well, this evening we're back at the Royal Albert Hall in an hour's time for our late prom. It's given by Penguin Cafe, the 21st century reincarnation of the Penguin Cafe Orchestra. Making its proms debut, Catherine Bott presents at 10:15. Before that, it's time for another Radio 3 Proms Composer Portrait. It was recorded earlier this evening and it's presented by Tom Service.
Welcome to the Amaryllis Fleming Concert Hall at the Royal College of Music, just over the road from the Royal Albert Hall, for this last composer portrait of this year's BBC Proms. We're going to hear 3 energetic, funky, grimy and uplifting pieces by 37-year-old Tansy Davis, performed by musicians from the Guildhall School of Music and Drama. And I'm delighted that Tansy joins me on stage here. Look, Tansy, you are, of course, making your living. You make your living as a composer now, but your musical life started really with the French horn and rock bands as well as orchestra. So when and where did it all start?
Well, in terms of earning a living, I suppose it began with the horn playing, which started as soon as I had done my degree, at sort of age 21. And I had a fabulous 3 years as a horn player, freelancing with some London orchestras, including the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra, and did some West End shows. And that was just a fabulous grounding for a composer to get to know what it's like working with musicians, you know, because sometimes it feels like the musicians are on the other side of the fence or something to composers. But sort of beginning gave me a great confidence in just knowing how to speak to musicians, I think. And I since discovered, well, as a student, a few years later than that, when I went on to study composition, that sometimes composers didn't really know quite how to speak with musicians, and I felt very fortunate that I'd had experience with them.
So you were starting as a composer at that time then?
I was always composing, but...
As a child as well, was it something you were...
Yeah, I suppose I started sort of actually writing down notes from age 13 or something. But I was also writing for sort of strange rock bands as well, because that was the kind of ensemble that was available to me, for me to work with. So I had friends who were really kind and let me write strange things for them. So
where was that, this experimental rock band? In Kent?
Yeah.
Okay. We're going to segue a bit now to Saltbox. Can you introduce the first work on tonight's programme we're going to hear, which is Saltbox? There is a relationship with what you were just saying, this fusion or different kinds of influence coming to play in the music.
I think so. It was never something I sort of did consciously, but in fact, Saltbox is a companion piece to Neon, which was written a year earlier.
And which we hear at the end of this programme.
Yeah, and that piece is really something which I consider to be a point in my music where the two sides, sort of the horn-playing side, the sort of classical side, and that really the my love of modernist music, and also the electric guitar-playing side, came together really into one shape, one thing, which is Neon. And it's more to do with the sounds of things like Stevie Wonder's Superstition, things like that, where he uses this fabulous clavinet sound, which I've used. And it's strange in the surface of the piece sounds really funky, that's Neon, but the construction is very classical in a sense. But going back to Saltbox, it's totally different. It's much more to do with landscape. So I'm working with, I suppose it's more, I'm thinking of films, like filmic landscapes, and at the same time there's a very gritty soundscape which you mentioned. And I think of Saltbox as a strange cross between Tom Waits and a Tarkovsky movie, I think. And it's these landscapes, sometimes quite melancholy. I wanted a complete contrast to neon, which is much more jolly. So that's Saltbox, really.
Well, let's hear it now. Musicians from the Guildhall School of Music and Drama in London, conducted by Ben Jernan.
Thank you. Thank you.
Tansy Davis's Salt Box, played by musicians from the Guildhall School of Music and Drama, conducted here at the Amaryllis Fleming Concert Hall, the Royal College of Music, by Ben Jernan. Tansy, the six acoustic instruments we've just been hearing, but also a clavinova, an electric piano, and a sampler. All three pieces we're going to hear, the next two as well, involve amplification and some use of electronic instruments and sampling. How important are these instruments to you, the kind of creepy noises that the sampler and the keyboard were making in that piece?
Well, in fact, the electronics were added later. That piece was written in 2005, and it still exists as a purely acoustic piece. But I felt I wanted to sort of widen the landscape by adding some electronic sounds. And I've been working for a couple of years only with electronics, so it's quite new to me. But it's important, very important, to have that sheen in the front or in the back, wherever it is, of the musical picture.
They are very visual. I mean, even the sound of the electric keyboard there, I mean, it has that sort of nostalgic quality of, I don't know, seaside Hammond organs in the 60s and 70s, and then also the sort of strange electroacoustic spaces that you open up. I mean, this isn't, it's not like an, in a way you're using the electronics here, not as an urban thing, but it's exactly the opposite, something to alienate the listener and alienate the sound world a bit.
Oh, I don't know about alienate, but it's interesting you say it's not an urban sound, because all those sounds were recorded in rural France on a very, very icy day in March this year. And I see this piece actually as very kind of rural, actually. I know there are these kind of elements of kind of pop music sounds coming in, but when I go back to the very beginnings of the piece, it was commissioned for the Battle of Trafalgar bicentenary celebrations in Chatham, in Kent. And I remember the original inspiration being the salt marshes around there. So for me, it's very much a landscape, and quite a melancholy landscape piece.
The title of the next piece we're going to hear, Grind Show Electric, seems to suggest a more directly kind of urban dark funkiness. What's going on in Grindshow Electric?
Well, again, this piece exists in two versions. The inspiration for this piece is a painting by Goya, Saint Isidora Pilgrimage, and I have a little picture in my mind which goes with this piece, and I'll try and tie it in with the Goya as well. Okay, so. This painting is one of people seemingly fleeing across a landscape towards the front of the painting, and it's at night time. And some of the people look very happy, and some look like they're not. And some are playing guitars, and some could be singing, some could be screaming. So it's ambiguous. And I was thinking about the sort of the back of the painting, in a way, as well as the front, and the relationship between the two. And I wanted to try and bring that into music. So I created a sort of landscape at the beginning, which I see as a sort of rainy night in somewhere very quiet, on a hillside, maybe in Spain, I don't know. But it's a dark, cold, rainy night. And in that landscape is a house. And in that house are four or five different large rooms. Within each room is a party going on, a different kind of party, different kind of scenery going on. And so that's what the piece is about, really, the outside landscape and the interior of these very bright scenes.
Okay, but so there's darkness and light then. I mean, yeah. What's going on in these rooms? Are people having fun, or are they up to?
I mean,
look, the title Grind Show suggests potentially at least ambivalent things happening in those rooms.
Yeah, that's kind of up to the imagination.
Is it?
But it's the thing to listen out for is that the way that each sort of dance scene, if you like, is framed by the dark, rainy sounds of the landscape.
And those rain
which
sounds
you'll
will
hear.
Actually hear in,
yeah,
in the
you
in
hear
the
a kind of, it's not actual rain, but it's a cross between rain and a crackly record sound.
Okay, so more of these dark electronics and warm potentially, well, who knows what's going on in the instrumental parts. Well, we're about to find out. Grind Show Electric, played by musicians from the Guildhall even School of Music and Drama, conducted by Ben Jernan.
Thank you.
Tansy Davis's grind show, Electric. Musicians from the Guildhall School of Music and Drama conducted in that performance by Ben Jernan. Tansy, I think I've got a slightly better idea about what those people in Goya's painting might have been up to in your imagination, or at least in mine, because there's an enormous amount of physical energy in that music, a lot of dancing, and yet it's sort of slightly warped, or I mean, these are dances that happen in seven, you know, like an extra beat rather than in three or four. And I just wonder if there's something in you somewhere where, like, pure sort of simple pleasure is something you resist and you want something more dark, more mysterious in every area of your life. I mean, I was just... But let's deal, though, first of all, with dancing, this idea of yeah. movement, at least.
Well, I don't know. I love the idea that somehow music is sorcery, and that's what I try to sort of do. I try to do sorcery of a kind in mine. So so quite often my music has the sheen of one thing, but actually it's made in a totally different way. So it's not the thing it sounds like, but I love the fact that it's balanced between those two things. And in terms of...
Give us an example of that. I mean, is there anything in Grencha we've just heard, something that that sounds maybe like a kind of, I don't know, 70s funk rhythm kind of, that's actually comes from a completely different place? Or...
Well, just take the honky-tonk piano sound, if you like, and the way it's written, which is in a sort of... The sound it produces is a sort of swing element, but the funny thing is it's written in a totally rigid and classical way, and I love that sort of twisting one thing into another. So I like the tensions of one thing trying to be another, and actually what comes out is somewhere between the two. So that's what interests me. So when it comes to these rhythms, I'm constantly working with new rhythmic patterns and trying to sort of wrong foot the listener, because I find that very exciting myself, when you think you've got a pattern but actually it's slightly different and it's tripping you up, and I think that's fun.
But you require your performers and your listeners then to kind of get into this groove, right, to in order to be able to experience those twists and turns, yeah. and feel them.
It's incredibly hard to play, I have to say. I mean, the effect is something which sounds like it's perhaps improvised or somehow occurring naturally, even though it's lopsided. But still, it's incredibly hard to achieve that effect. So these musicians are fantastic.
We're listening to these three pieces on a chamber scale tonight. But is that twisting and turning, generically speaking, on every level, also true of your bigger pieces, your orchestral pieces, or your music theatre works like Elephant and Castle that you wrote for the Opera Festival? I mean, even when you're writing a trumpet concerto or an orchestral piece, are you always thinking about this idea of wrong-footing or sorcerizing one thing into another?
Probably, I think so. I think in terms of the rhythm, though, I try to explore that in the chamber pieces, because when it comes to an orchestra, you automatically get sort of distortions anyway, because there's so many people playing. Even if you write straight crotchets and quavers, things don't always sound together. But that's the beauty of an orchestra. It's this huge thing which is unwieldy and fantastic in many ways, but not as good at doing these highly intricate rhythmical things that you can do with a chamber ensemble.
The last piece we're going to hear this evening, Neon, is also the earliest piece you wrote, 2004. A lot of intricacy in this music.
Yes, this is really hard to play again. It has the sheen of something which just makes you want to tap your foot. But if you do, you might trip up occasionally. You might stop because it's mostly in seven or something else. And I'm working again with sort of cog wheels, I like to think of them, grooves which are lopsided, and different sizes of cog wheels interlocking with each other so that things are cycling around, but nothing is ever the same twice. Although the material is very similar, you recognise things, it never comes quite the same twice.
Is that kind of process inspired by anyone, or is that the sort of Davis DNA?
It's just me being playful, I think. I love working in this way and inventing things like that. Someone described this piece once as being like a Rubik's Cube, the way it's been put together, and I think that's quite a good description of it, actually, because it's quite similar in the sound of it in many ways, but if you try and sort of grab hold of it, it will always not quite slot into the patterns you're aiming for.
A word on the title, Neon. Again, that suggests a visual, strong visual element, or inspiration to the piece.
Mm. Oh, well, actually, at the time of writing this piece, I saw a fabulous exhibition in Birmingham at the Icon Gallery of work by David Batchelor. And one of the things that he's been fascinated by is colour. And he's written a book called Chromophobia, I think. And he's done a series of installations and photographs which involve fluorescent colours on a very, very bleak black and white background. So like a photograph of a bright pink fluorescent stuffed panda bear lying on a grimy London pavement, and the contrast of those things, which I think there's something of that in the piece. Anyway.
So basically, this piece, Neon, then, is a programmatic description of a pink panda bear on a grimy London street, right?
That's it.
Good. Tansy Davis is Neon, musicians from the Guildhall School of Music and Drama, and once again conducted by Ben Jernan.
Thank you.
Tansy Davis's Neon. Musicians from the Guildhall School of Music and Drama, conducted by Ben Jernan. Our thanks to all the musicians for their work in putting together this fantastic, vivid programme, to Tansy Davis for joining us this evening, and to you all for being here at the Amaryllis Fleming Concert Hall at the Royal College of Music. Thank you.
That Proms composer portrait of Tansy Davis was recorded earlier this evening and edited for broadcast. The presenter was Tom Service. Well, there's more live music from the Proms in just under a quarter of an hour. A late night concert by Penguin Cafe. We'll be joining Catherine Bott for that at 10:15. So before that, it's time to rifle through our CD cabinet again. Now, I have noticed that I do tend to go for the drawer marked piano solo quite often when choosing things to play for you. I thought it was time for a change. So, here's something for two pianos.
Thank you.
Well, as you may have worked out after the long introduction, that was the Russian dance from Tchaikovsky's Swan Lake. It's from a disc recorded by Daniel Blumenthal and Robert Grolo, and the arranger, none other than the 18-year-old Claude Debussy, who made the transcription for Tchaikovsky's patroness, Nadezhda von Meck, while he was living with her as music tutor to her children. Well, a decade later, long after he'd left the family's service, Debussy made another transcription, and you may recognise this one if you either are a violin virtuoso or if you admire somebody else who is one. And if you're a fan of the key of A minor, this is your lucky evening. This is the introduction and Rondo Capriccioso by Saint-Saëns. Debussy, the transcriber, raiding the violinist's repertoire. That was his two-piano arrangement of the introduction and Rondo Capriccioso by Camille Saint-Saëns. Daniel Blumenthal and Robert Grollo were the pianists on that disc. This is BBC Radio 3. We're broadcasting on 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and online. It's 10:15. At 11:45 tonight, Max Reinhardt will be here to introduce...